Today's date is February the 1st, 2010. My name is Jonathan Gerland. We're at the History Center, and I am with Stacy Cook, who was a member of the Diboll Independent School District Board of Trustees during school integration. And I believe he went on the board in April of 66. And maybe we could just begin by just asking you, how did you come to serve on the school board? How did that happen?
Well, I had moved here in December of 1961, December the 11th, as a matter of fact, to join Temple, and really at that time at the furniture manufacturing facility. And I'm saying all that, I was, in 61, I was about 26 years old, I guess, so I was young. And by the time, you know, I had, was having children coming along 60, 58, 64, 66. So, you know, having children, you naturally have a little more interest in schools and what's going on. And I just, you know, wanted to be of some service to the community, I think, too. And, you know, I think any younger, you're more challenged and willing to do those things. So, not any particular reason other than that, I think, just the desire to do what you could for the community you're going to live in.
What was your own background? Comment, if you would, on your family, how you were raised, where you grew up, maybe or what was your some experiences with race relations?
You bet. I grew up in a little community called Rigger Springs, situated about halfway between Ennis and Waxahachie, Texas, a farming community. My dad ran a little country grocery store where I grew up. He was doing that from the time I was born until the time I left home, and then after that. But anyway, of course, in that area, there were a lot of blacks. There were sharecroppers for the people that worked there. So a lot of our trade was black people. And I'm mentioning that because we're talking about integration ultimately here.
Right.
I know that. So, but it did give you some probably a little deeper insight of things. And my dad was always very cordial to all people, and my good Christian man, and but a lot of our trade was with black people. And at that time, it was kind of interesting, the farmers, you know, I remember my dad would say that in regard to the sharecropper that was on their place, that he would be responsible, say, for anything they didn't pay over $100 or something like that. So dad would extend them credit, you know, during the growing season and then fall. So there was that relationship early on, and played with both races, but of course schools were very much segregated in those days, and there was some presumption of that's just the way it was, and we'd all inherited that situation, and of course they were natural regarding the years. We know, you think back, and I was born in 35, well that's not a real long time after the Civil War. So I live now, I'm 75 years old, time's a lot shorter than it used to be. So, you know, we had a war over that, and Civil War history has always been an interesting thing to me anyway, and I've done a lot of reading on that, but one of the historians, I believe, I can't recall his name, said it was the war that defined us as a nation, whether we truly held to those principles that were set forth in the Constitution about all men being created free and equal. So, I think the change was probably being set maybe in my generation coming up. We, you know, worked, played together and those things. And anyway.
So, and you were born in 1935, right?
35, okay. Right. March 30th, 1935.
And you graduated from high school there?
I went my first 6 years to country school. Had four grades in one room. There were two-room school out. About by the seventh grade, they had started busing, and we went in Waxahachie, and that's where I finished high school. So going on from there, I went to University of North Texas and got a degree in accounting. And married one of my classmates of that year at school, and went to work for Arthur Anderson in Dallas Public Accounting. Did that for about a year and a half, and had a I took ROTC in college and was commissioned to go in the Air Force. Went in the Air Force in what wound up to be 2 years because it was peacetime. I had an early out. Came back to Dallas and Arthur Anderson until then. I had a fraternity brother in college who was ahead of me. He'd already out in school in the field, and he was making distressed furniture tops for case goods in the furniture industry. Of course, Temple was buying these tops from him, or Stubblefield, actually, who worked for Temple, as you know. And so in this process, my friend and Stubby were communicators, and Stubby was looking for someone to set up a call system at the furniture plant. And so I learned of that, and I didn't know where Diba was. My wife had grown up in Palestine, graduated high school, went to college from there. So I kind of fell in love with East Texas when I was dating her. And so I come down for that interview and with Stubby, Stubblefield, and he hired me, and he was busy, I guess, and I didn't hear. I was anxious to come. I was ready to get out of Dallas and public accounting and come back to my country roots. I think I had a lot of it to do with it. Diboll was it obviously looked like to me a growing town, an opportunity to do accounting like I'd like to, where you're closer to operations. And so it was an opportunity. And I remember calling him back and says, I hadn't heard from you yet. Are you interested? So he finally invited me on down. Took a $25 a month cut to come to Diboll, and sold my house in Richardson, Texas, where I was living.
Describe, if you would, maybe Diboll as a community during that time. You said you came in 61. Just remindful that, you know, the city didn't even incorporate as a municipality until 62. So if you would, just sort of set the stage from your perspective of Diboll, and then again, specifically with race relations, schools, and that kind of thing.
Well,
when you move,
I'll try to do it quickly. I tend to be a man of too many words. So, but anyway, yes, we moved here, and of course, the first question was a place to live. I had lived, as I said, in Richmond. I communicated downtown Dallas every day, and boy, I was burnt out on that rat race and the wreck on the freeway every day. And I was again crying. The country was crying out for me. We came here, and therefore I wanted to live as close, I used to say, as to the smokestack as I could. I just, driving long distance, I'd had my fill of that. So I wanted to live in Diboll, and Lottie Temple had a house here for rent. It was her residence, and it was for rent, and I think I rented for $75 a month. And so we did that and settled in. As to the community, of course, the Pine Bough restaurant was here, and it was a great place to eat. Such good food. Everybody enjoyed going there for lunch, both in and out of town. But local grocery store, Publix, and I believe another store over here. And but a small community, small, slower action, and kind of very interesting to me. It was a real breath of life for me after Dallas.
Okay. Okay, we're jumping forward now, I guess, to when you were on the school board. And like I said, I believe you came on in April of 66, and that was the same
time
that Buddy Temple came on.
We came on the same time.
Y'all came on together. What was some of your earliest memories of serving on the school board? Where was integration as an issue at that time?
Well,
in the context of maybe other issues that might have come up,
what was? You have to go back, and of course, when the civil rights movement started in '64, well, they were obvious. You knew in all of this there was a risk of disaster almost, because there's some people very strongly felt it shouldn't take place, and the civil rights movement was going on, and there was a lot of resentment, and. I didn't sense that so much here, and not that I even thought about it, but at least I think that there was in the air the feeling that this needed to be done. I mean, anybody's it feels like you're a law-abiding citizen when the government of the land says this must be done, then you know that you got to either face abiding by the law. Are the results that come from not doing that. And so a reasonable man knows that we got to try to do this, but the question is how, and how to do it peacefully. And when I was talking about the air here, the tone, Mr. Temple, as you know, Mr. Arthur Temple Jr. was a man who very much cared for the people. He was very concerned about that, and that included whites and blacks and hard-working people on both ends of the thing. So I think there was the feeling that, as far as the company was concerned, and I was working for the company, that there wasn't going to be any resistance for sure on the company's part, because you just knew that he was interested in all the people, and he had, and so that set the tone, I think, for that which would follow. There were, as I read a few articles, just try to brief my memory on all this some, and you know, there were in our time about three or four school board members that were for this and a couple that weren't, and it wasn't. I don't think it was so much. They were older men. They were out of another generation that to where this was very new to them, whereas the rest of us were younger. And a couple of these men were in business here, and they had, I'm sure they had, you know, they had integrated trade, and part of their living came off. So you can't, just like my dad was in the back of the grocery store. Not that it was driven by an economic factor, but it was, had to be a consideration, you know. So, yeah, I think the tone was here where we knew it was doable, and you knew it needed to be done. And the question was just how in the world you're going to do it and hopefully maintain peace and order in the community.
I think I know the answer to this question, but did the school board ever hear directly from Arthur Temple Jr. in any way?
Never. I've commented on that. This is absolute truth. I worked for the company 35 years, and even in only about 15 of that, or 14 or 15 on the school board in the early days. But never in the midst of all this kind of situation did I ever, any word come down to me through the chain that I needed to do something one way or the other. And so, and I was thankful for that, of course.
A little bit out of order here. We're kind of going back a little bit, but you and I were speaking earlier about more of the setting of the community. Of course, the city incorporated in 62. There were a lot of federal funded projects then ongoing, such as that the establishment of the housing authority, the library. The public library had some federal funds, and just a whole host of other projects that, in the big scheme of things, Diboll was a very progressive town. Do you care to comment on any of that and how that might have related into school integration with complying with federal maybe mandates, you might say? Or
I really don't know. We would say behind the scenes. Now, you know, I know that Mr. Temple was probably a Democrat. I think he probably was a Democrat at that time. And Lyndon Johnson was president following, of course, Kennedy's assassination in 63, which was a very traumatic thing. But I remember somebody that was somewhere one time that talked about Lyndon looking over and saying, "Hi, Arthur." So I'm sure Arthur was contributing to that. But now, of course, I've since lived long enough and studied history enough and read current events now to know that that companies and people contribute to parties, and that's the way it's run. You can argue that all day, and you can talk about this too much of it. But I don't know to what extent, even if any, that had on, say, probably HUD or whoever it was that provided, you know, where the money was provided to do. But I look at it more now from a managerial standpoint, because at that time, from the plywood plant that I was going to go to work in 64 and become manager of in 65 was built on property that had formerly been the shacks of the old town. And all that was torn, you know, and moved, and Mr. Temple, and moved the
and this
people
was the
further.
Black, this was the historically segregated black community.
That's right.
Where the plywood
That's
was
right,
built.
Exactly. And so the what was it, the Garrett Ranch, I believe, area they used to call it, and he went down and built other houses for them, and thus there was improvement. You regardless of how you feel politically at the time, you had the black man had a better opportunity. And they like, I remember one of my first college classes was I want to say social study. What is it? I'm thinking about sociology. And it always stood out to me one learning thing you read, that people resist change. Just a truth. And so, naturally, there was some resistance. And I think there would be some resistance to a lot of people, the black people who lived the way they had lived, and they had their house that they lived in. They probably hated to give that up. I think I remember some of that. It wasn't maybe perhaps a big thing, but a very personal thing, I guess. But overall, you look back, then came the public housing. I've been on that board too. My reflection on that is, you know, in a more worldwide fashion, I really think maybe the government would have been wiser had they made an opportunity for people to get a loan and build a house somewhere, just because I think that in a way we've created a situation where people are living so closely that even there's probably some resentment there. This crime that we know this grows out of those kind of situations. Maybe it could have been done a better way, but it even at that, if there was the opportunity for above substandard livings that were going on at the time.
What did what was the talk on the town, so to speak? What did you hear directly from your constituents as a representative on the school board, and specifically to the integration issue? At church, co-workers.
Really.
Did that ever?
I don't remember anybody. Probably, other than what I would sense say at a board meeting, because of the other couple of guys, and it wasn't that they were adamantly opposed. I think they were probably a little more afraid of where this would take us. And I'm saying that's probably about the only time that I remember any hard discussions. I don't remember coming in and saying, "What are you doing? You know, you guys gone crazy." There never was anything that said to me like that. And I don't really sense that in the community too much. I think that most reasonable people realized that this was going to take place one way or the other. We could do it with an armed force like that went to Little Rock, wasn't it, I believe, on integration back in those days. Or you could just try to make it peacefully work. And so that was our charge, I think.
Let's look at maybe, if you can recall, any of the issues involved with integration. Where I'm getting with that is, do you remember anything about, say, the disposition of the teachers as the children integrated? Maybe concern for adequate number of facilities, integrated sports, social interactions. And also recall that the school district had just recently expanded, irregardless of integration, with bringing in the Beulah School District. Are the Beulah schools, the Burke School had just recently been brought into the Dieball schools. Maybe just the growth overall of the district, and then how integration fit into that. Do you recall any?
Well, it's a little difficult to remember all that, but I know there had to have been problems. You know, that would be just the ongoing type of board problems where you're trying to do what you've got to do within the funds that are available through taxation. So, I guess being 15 years on the board, I remember a time when people, you know, they're against raising taxes anyway, so
right.
It's hard to relate that, say, to necessarily integration. But, yeah, I've read some of the articles that went in the Free Press in that era to refresh my memory a little bit. And, I, for example, at the Temple School, which was the old colored school, the black school, I remember Mr. Massey was principal at that time, and a very good man, very quiet and gentle and able to balance things, I think. But I read in the articles about the coaches that were, as integration started, there weren't enough boys going to sign up for football to make a viable team. And
on the black school.
On the black school, right. Yeah. And so we were, you know, the government was saying you're going to have to integrate sports too, and he came to the meeting and said that he couldn't field a good team and his coaches had resigned, and so it was time to do that. But the building, I'm reading again, I think the elementary school was already pretty well pushed to capacity, and here we're going to open school. So how do you re-prorate students, not only students but teachers? You've got black teachers too. And so it couldn't have been an easy time. I don't remember all those details now, but I just know from the logistics of buildings and people and all of it. It's amazing. Probably we didn't have more problems than we had, I guess.
I think the state education administration came down in November of 66, and at that time was recommending the school district to add 2.5 classrooms and 2.5 teachers per year. Yeah. As the school was growing, so that's a
they probably big. Didn't fund that mandate either.
No.
That's the thing you got into, even with the federal thing. That
right.
There wasn't any federal money coming along, said, okay, we're going to build you the buildings to do this.
Well, and I think the school district, too, was building a lot of temporary buildings, and they were even advising not to do that, we needed something a little more permanent.
Well, we did a lot of that, because I remember being involved in that, going to other schools, and that was a little later, but we had to start adding them.
I was looking back at some of the school board minutes, and I think at the very first meeting, I got a little tickled out of this. You made the suggestion that the school board be reviewed by Axley and Rohde, auditors. I remember when you came on our board here at the History Center, we started using Axley Rohde too. But if you could, and do you remember anything about school finances as an accountant? Coming in, what was your first impression of how things were ran? And
well, yeah, as an accountant, that got me probably more involved. I remember not long ago, John Ralph Poland was telling me when he was on the school board, we talked about getting spread bids, and one of the bids had come in lower, and I guess the accountant, I had figured out how many slices of bread were in each loaf, and actually the other bid was going to be cheaper on his face. He said it kind of astounded him. He hadn't thought about it that way. Okay, but getting back to your question. Apparently we felt, well, Mr. Tate, I mean, Pate, was, I mean, he's pretty well loaded. Now, he's an older man, getting near retirement. We've got integration. And as he said, from the days he had been in school, a superintendent that always involved teaching, overseeing, changing light bulbs, sweeping the floor, and the whole ball of wax. Well, things you're getting a little more, you have more population now, and schools are getting busier, and it's obvious it's wearing on him. And so some of us felt we needed a business manager, and you mentioned that in the audit. I remember that coming up because it had become, the idea of here bringing in a business manager was I guess felt like the thing to do by some, and therefore I got my timing mixed up a little bit, but Pop Rich had been hired as business manager, and in there were some insinuations that surely he must not be doing things just right, or perhaps there wasn't all on the up and up. And I knew better because I knew Pop and I knew the family. I just knew and knew the board members that were kind of against that. And I just didn't feel like we could go anywhere until we get that resolved. So I just made a motion, I think, that every expenditure over a certain dollar amount be looked at by the auditors. And I think that passed, and we did that. And sure enough, nothing came up. And that was the end of that. Then we had a business manager from then on. I don't remember all the details about why, but I think I felt that we needed someone riding closer on finances. That was not to anyone's detriment. It was just the fact that it was just good business to do.
I noticed also in the minutes, and it came up in the context of taxes, whether the valuations were going to be raised or the tax rate was mm-hmm. going to be raised, but to cover and I believe it was in September of 66 that Temple Industries made a $63,000 donation, which was equal to the school debt at that time.
Yeah.
And was that common?
I don't not that I recall. I don't even remember that.
Okay.
But and yet I kind of do too. And I suspect, that rather than raise taxes, I don't know the economic situation in 66.
Yeah, this would have been early on in your time.
It could have been that they just...
I think it was like they had like a three-year carryover of debts. And the context, I think, was that Dieball was... The school district was being very cautious in what they did.
Right.
It was even mentioned that all the other school districts where Temple owned land, which, as you know, they own forest lands all over East Texas.
District, that's right. Yeah.
But whatever Dieball schools did, they followed suit. So it was maybe a little more important. and
well,
they didn't take it lightly.
Standpoint, I don't know.
But then the company.
I don't know
made
that. You know, I don't know that the board went to the company and, you know, and asked for money.
Yeah, you know, no,
but
I wasn't
I suspect that the company knew this school was having that kind of problem and just decided that was the best way to take care of it.
But to your knowledge,
just donate that to our.
During your time, did that ever come up again, or
not that I recall?
Okay.
Not that I recall. In fact, I suspect. You know, I think the company for sure by this time is wanting more to get out of that type of thing, because back in the old days of, you know, owning houses and renting, Mr. Temple, I know he wanted to get out of that era and let people have be on their own and get out of the commissary idea, et cetera. So I think that kind of attached to that would just be more of the parental type oversee of the school, and I just know we weren't under any gun about
okay.
that. I think it's a matter of expediency probably that year.
How did integration progress, the plan, the Freedom of Choice plan, which was actually adopted before you came on the board, I believe in 65, the 65-66 yep. year, roughly 20 black students had enrolled or expressed their intention to go to the formerly all-white schools, but only one student actually did, and that was Valerie Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
The following year, I think roughly 40 or 41 signed intentions and did go
yeah.
to those schools. Anything that you recall, progress, any issues that came before the school board and connection
with it? No, not that you asked me if I recall. That's
yeah.
a problem at this many years to recall, but no, I think it was probably even on the part of the black community. They probably enrolled, and then when the time came, it was getting hard for them to leave the school. Because there wasn't any pressure that I know of that would try to keep people from actually showing up. I think the next year is just a revelation, and it just took that time for the things to start settling in, soaking in. Problems. Not offhand, there'd be problems that would come up. You might have a scuffle between boys in school, fisticuffs, and that went on before immigration too. But if it got between races, that might get kicked. You know, people a little more noticing of that. The school, I think, worked very hard in that time. The principals of the school knew the families and knew the children, and they knew, let's just say you had and I think I remember a case maybe of a black boy and a white boy getting in a fight. One boy, maybe the white boy, gets a little different punishment, but then when we were interested in those kind of things, and we'd say, why was this boy sent home and the other one was say, given capital punishment, a good spanking? And they'd say, well, if we sent this boy home, he's going to be out on the street. If we sent this boy home, his parents are going to know. And we knew his parents, we knew they'd take care of the problem. So it was, you know, and so as we got in, and that's kind of an example of one thing I remember, then questioning, you found out there was some common sense of educators to know how to deal with those better than we did as a board, and where we get more political at that level, you know.
All right. But there were a few cases you... Do remember where that
come
before the board?
Well, yeah, but very few.
Okay.
The only coming that's coming before the board.
What about teachers? Again, I didn't have the opportunity to go through all the minutes, but I remember there was one, a black teacher, Odessa Wallace.
Wallace, uh-huh.
I think, was questioned. She was teaching at the formerly all-white school, and that maybe...
At the former all-white, all-black
yes,
school?
She was a black teacher teaching at the white school, I believe.
Okay.
And
by that time.
Yes, sir. And she was come under question as to maybe her disciplinary actions or maybe even her grading. Do you remember anything about that? And actually, I think B. Burkhalter, made some defense of her, a white teacher defending... you know, saying that she did not do anything out of the ordinary.
Oh, I see. You're saying that she stood in the defense of Odessa.
Right, right.
Odessa, I think.
Yeah, I think Patsy the other day had found out a different way to pronounce her first name, but
I remember her. I don't. It apparently wasn't a big issue.
Okay.
I don't remember any much about that.
But to your knowledge, you don't recall any incidences like that where teachers might have come under question, white or black. You know, the black community questioning some.
Not right off.
White teachers or anything. Okay. And you mentioned your children. How many children do you have?
I have four children. My oldest was born in 58, so by the time I moved here in 61, he was only three or four. My next daughter was born in 60. She's entered and made the first grade by this time, I guess, and he's a couple of grade years ahead of her. Then that's about a four-year gap. And my last two were born in 64 and 66. All of my children graduated here and went on to.
Do you recall anything from your two oldest children when school? I mean, did they attend school, all white school, and then integration happened while they were?
Yeah, integration would largely have happened, I guess, you know, while they were. My first two were, you know, in elementary school. It would be right. 58 plus 6 is what? 64. So. He's just beginning the first grade in 64, so not at that level. But when my children were involved, there were enough years, I think, took place that we were pretty well settled in by the time said they go to mid school or high school, where generally just when their problems began.
Yeah.
So, but I don't remember any big issues. I think it was more challenging, and not of the. It's not saying, you know, our country was somewhat responsible for the fact because of poorer plants and facilities for the education of the black, they were a little bit behind. I mean, with all due respect, they were. And so when you integrate, you got to kind of teach now to both levels, and so that was probably more of a challenge. For the teacher, but it had to be done.
Do you remember where the school board meetings were held?
Yes, I remember my chief members. The high school was the school that sits here by the History Center now. At that time, it was high school, then it's junior high. And you walk in the front door, and it seems to me that the meeting room is off to the right or left, right as you enter the room. That's where most of the meetings that I recall took place.
How did a typical meeting progress? You served on a lot of boards and different things. How would you describe it in context of that?
Yeah, I think generally the agenda probably was made up by the superintendent, and, you know, just the things that we were going to address in that meeting. And it's been a while, but probably review the budget. That was a big change during the summer, getting ready for it. And there was always the question, you know, one thing we used to fuss about with coaches, you know, coaches, I think, seemed like to me they had their meeting, they had a state meeting in August, and you'd find out that some of your coaches had been hired away by another district. So those were always issues. Staffing, you know, people resigning and hiring new teachers and a lot of changes. I remember we had way back sometime by the time David Foster, I believe, was the man we hired to follow Mr. Pate. And he was a good man. He was beginning the turning of things here. I brought that up for a reason now, Steve. That's what happens as you age.
We were just talking about the meetings and how they progressed and that kind of thing. Does that help?
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Well,
how long did you serve on the school board?
I believe it was about 14 or 15 years. I think we closed the Dyball plywood plant in 79, shut her down in October 79, and it was about that time somewhere, so if my memory serves.
Okay.
And so I went on, and what did you say, 60, we said 66, so 66 to 79, 13, 14 years.
Okay. And since you served, you know, not at the very beginning, but certainly near the beginning of integration and all the way through, how would integration play in maybe the big scope of things? And I just thought of this. I know it's been said, you know, Dieball integrated much earlier than other schools.
I think that's right.
And,
yeah.
And you know, Lufkin, I remember even 99 or 2000, we're still under some kind of a
mandate,
federal, a review policy or something, and that wasn't lifted until just, you know, within the past 10 years, I guess. How comment on that, if you would. How do you feel about all that?
Yeah, I, again, in my review of the paper articles, I say that Huntington was moving about the time we were. Now, it said, you know, it was hard to tell, but I mean, they're a fairly close school district, reliable on tax money too, I guess. But I had recalled, I thought in my mind, we were pretty early on, and I was reading the time lapse, like the time Commissioner of Education approved our plan was not a long term. And I thought, gee, of all the districts over the nation that must be putting in this information, you'd think it'd take forever to get word back. But that, again, makes me think there weren't probably a lot of them doing it. I think we were fairly early on.
Well, and you almost get the impression, too, that Dieball expressed an early interest in doing it. I think one of the very first mentions when it came up, I don't think a specific vote was recorded, but when it was first presented, the school board, you know, said, yeah, well, just what you were saying, that we're going to do it. It's just, you know, a matter of the details. Yeah. And you get the impression, too, that I think that last year the school board voted to go freedom of choice one more year.
Yeah, and that was a feeling of...
And then, like, the next month, the review board came down and says, you know, what's really holding you up? And I said, well,
you're talking about the Fed coming.
You're right.
That's right.
And
but it was, I think we said, you know, after all, we've got this mandate. The Fed says, here's what you got to do. You need to do it. But at the same time, we're sitting here amongst the people, and you're knowing this, and, you know, this can be a fireable issue. And so let's use some reason here. And I think the logic would look, well, it would be more likely, let's integrate the first grade, say, and let time kind of take care of that process. You know, that was, I know, had to be in some of the early discussions, and I think we did that in the paper article I read. I think we came up with that kind of a stair step, and well, that wasn't going to be acceptable. And
because, you know,
it wasn't resistant. We were just trying to make it work in our community as best we thought could, but they weren't going to accept that.
Right. Well, I was just wondering, you know, because you would maybe, hopefully, correctly assume that they were doing the same thing on all these school districts.
Yeah.
And, for instance, Lufkin, for whatever reason, you know,
and more resistant.
More resistant. So that's what I was getting at, is that maybe, you know, obviously,
I think that's evidence of the
resistance.
Fact.
It didn't put up a fight.
That's right.
If there was,
and I think it was because of, largely because of the company and the Temple's influence. I really do. That here we've got working people. We got to take it, Mr. Temple. You know, and probably saying you've been around long enough to know. He made the statement, "What's good for the company is good for you." And I mean, he'd be talking about his managers then, people like me. And I'm not talking now in regard to integration, but in whatever thing, if we need to take a cut that year or not get an increase, or I don't even remember specifically what I'm talking about. I just remember there was that rule, and one thing I do remember saying, I guess one time when we were talking about political action committees, you know, when that movement became, it went into management because the unions were getting such power and such an ear at Congress that I don't know what administration, but it felt like there was time that management have some, if you know, feeding into the political. I never was personally a believer in the political action committees, but I think that's one of them, Mr. Temple saying it, because he was saying, look, you know, the company needs legislation favorable to the forest industry. And all that implies, if we're going to stay in business, it's a very logical business decision. And therefore, you need the right to have some balance in this thing between, you know, between labor. And I don't know if he went into all that detail at the time, but I know now from reading history that's kind of the way this evolved. And he made that statement, so, you know, I guess I got on board. But there would come the time when I would begin personally just to take political action, because I felt like sometime maybe whoever the company was interested in going to Congress was not the guy I wanted, and so it would be, I'd just be offsetting my own vote. I had some discussions about that.
Excuse me, but just ignore my phone. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but that's it. I'm just saying that there was that idea, and I'm saying that even regard the integration. If we must do this, and we need to take care of our people, and I'm reading behind the scenes now, that this was never in public known to me, but I would just imagine that Mr. Temple tried to do all he could to make Dyball a better place to live, and if that involved some federal funds to build better housing, it was going to go somewhere. And therefore, I think his philosophy probably generally was, if it's good for the company, it's good for us. And no one was, it wasn't being forced on us. I think that was just a thing that had to happen. It would be the same, you know, we went to, the company did to Mexico, and was instrumental in bringing a lot of Spanish in because you needed those people to fill those jobs. So this building, you know, these new industries we're getting into, particle board, plywood, and other things. Those people had to work in those mills, had to come from somewhere, and the labor base to do probably that kind of labor in the beginning wasn't here. So, in a way, that had to do not only with black integration, but with the Spanish too, I think.
Yeah. Well, comment a little bit on that, if you would. When you said you served through 79, when did the Hispanic families come in? I've forgotten.
Well, it was before that.
Did that come up in the school board? I mean,
well, I remember in running the plywood, just running the plywood, we began to have several Spanish people that were coming in. So that had to be somewhere between 65, the period when I started there, until during that 65 to 79 years, in there somewhere.
Right.
And probably earlier, even in the early part of that, I'd think, probably.
But your experiences on the school board, you know.
Oh, for the Spanish?
Yeah, yeah. What was there, not that anything I, that came not that made I it to that level?
No. Okay. I think it was probably the case that many of the Spanish families, not being able to speak the language of the parent, mother, and dad that came in, and wanted their children to be integrated. They were generally, the Spanish family seemed to me to be a pretty close family-knit company, group, and family. And I'm saying that they didn't make waves. I think they just, but they weren't, I don't think at the same time that somehow in our culture the Spanish weren't more as resisted as the blacks were, going back to this old earlier times, and i.e. the Civil War and all that came out of that, and probably more importantly Reconstruction was, you know, it's just sad that we had to fight that war and didn't take care of the thing better after the war was over.
Did you regularly attend sporting events, say Dyball High School football game,
oh, yeah,
or something like that?
During that time, yeah. During my days on school board, at least, and
right.
My boys were playing.
Do you remember those first years of integration with Dyball having black, say, football players?
Well,
and maybe the opposing teams, were they integrated, as you recall?
I don't recall all that so much. I remember there were some pretty good black football players, and one of which went on, I think got a scholarship and then went to pro ball, and I don't think it lasted a long time.
Mac Mitchell,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
And so there was some good. I think athletically we probably, you know, and now I think you could pretty easily say that black guys pretty well dominate the football sports arena because they're good at it. They're good.
Okay, Stacy, that's pretty much all the specific questions I had. Is there anything that you wanted to add and follow up? You've already given us sort of a broad perspective of everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not necessary, but I just want to give you the opportunity if there was anything that you wanted to add. Or
oh, boy, it just becomes more nostalgic now with so many years. I was here, from all of 62 to when I left in 2007, 2008. I guess I moved to Houston in 2008. Just I remarried on the loss of my wife. But now coming back, you know, I just it's hard to fathom all those years you spent here doing what we did day in and day out. And I had the privilege yesterday of assisting at a funeral for James McGuire. James was a longtime operator of the bandmill and the sawmill, and a good friend of mine, a member of our church, and I'm still kind of remembering that very clearly, the sadness of his family. Because he had a great family, hardworking man, didn't have a lot of education, but very good, and the funeral home was just filled with people that knew him. And he's one of the old-time guys, right out of the sawmill, hardworking. There's houses all over this country that have them constructed other boards. He sliced off those logs. And there were a lot of men like him that even preceded him back through those years. So the years in plywood that I spent while here, and then after we closed the plywood plant, we shuttered it. We had built a pylon operation by then, and they converted that sawmill to a plywood plant in 73, 74, about 10 years after we started Diebold. And it was more modern, and we carried on until they changed it back to lumber a few years back. So a lot of things happened, yeah, a lot of memories.
All right, well, thank you very much.
You bet.